But we're joined now by Tiefen Dixon, a legal scholar and lawyer who has practiced law before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and for Yugoslavia, and all in all around expert. Are you there, Tiefen?
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us. This is a big, we have, a big subject. And I noticed that the international media so far is not giving this subject a lot of attention. From your work and writings, I know that you must view this as highly significant, that the Philippines has decided to, as of March 14, to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. And the phrase that they I did see that they used was that the court had become politicized and weaponized, and therefore that was, to the extent it's being treated by the media, that's what's being said. Well, actually, I guess I should ask you, can you summarize what their view of this is and why they think it's necessary to withdraw?
Oh, yeah. So this is really a significant event in the history of the ICC. There, of course, Burundi has now withdrawn from the ICC. And, you know, we remember hearing previously from the Gambia, the Gambian leadership calling the ICC, rather than the International Criminal Court, the infamous Caucasian Court. And so it was, you know, kind of understandable that African states might
Why did they use that phrase?
Well, because the ICC has only prosecuted Africans. And I remember back in 2011.
No Caucasians have committed any offenses, right?
Well, I mean, that's sort of the assumption. I remember back in 2011 with a group of students looking at the ICC website. This was exactly about the time that Muammar Gaddafi and his son and his chief of intelligence services had been indicted by the ICC, despite not being a signatory, so via the United Nations Security Council, you know, strongly at the request of the United States, who's not itself a signatory, and who abstained and managed to get a provision that non-member states wouldn't pay for any prosecutions that the Security Council had sent over to the ICC, which is completely unfair. But we were looking at the FAQs, you know, frequently asked questions. Mm-hmm. So one of these questions was, are only Africans prosecuted by the ICC? That's a frequently asked question, right? Is it true that it's only Africans that are prosecuted?
Yes.
And their answer was essentially, yes, but no. And maybe only Africans are prosecuted, but really, it's because we care about the African victims. And we're, you know, we're open to prosecuting others who are not African, but we happen to right now be in this situation where we have only African cases. And so it won't surprise you that that's no longer in the FAQs, because it's a completely preposterous answer to a very reasonable question.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the Philippines decision might be surprising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Burundi's statement had said that the ICC was a political instrument and a weapon used by the West to enslave other states.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, in the sense that Africans are persecuted by the ICC. And in the case of the Philippines, this is a response to a preliminary examination by the ICC's prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, into potentially alleged crimes against humanity that would have been committed by the Filipino political leadership in the context of I guess you could call it a drug war there in the Philippines. And the reaction by the President Rodrigo Duterte was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 15 page explanation of the decision to withdraw, and it's based primarily on the Constitution of the Philippines, 1987. And emphasizes a few things. such as the presumption of innocence and due process. So the allegation is that to embark on this preliminary examination is presuming guilt of President Duterte, of the Filipino police services, etc. So that's the first claim, is this is a presumption of guilt, and that probably in the international community there will not be sort of sophisticated examination of the difference between this preliminary examination and an actual eventual conviction.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think they're not exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So once that war criminal moniker is used, it's very difficult to overcome. So in that sense, I think the authors of that statement are very sophisticated and seem to have a pretty sharp historical understanding of how these international criminal courts actually work, and mm-hmm. that they're so sanguine. I mean, remember the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and Yugoslavia. You'll recall that the very title, is the International Criminal Tribunal for the prosecution of persons responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
So the title of the institution already presumes the guilt of any potential suspect.
Yes.
So they're correct in pointing that out. They also make an even stronger claim, which I think has a pretty solid basis, that their signature and ratification of the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court was in fact fraudulent.
I like that argument. By the way, I was very impressed with that. Incidentally, this can be found online. I want to thank you very much for providing it for us for this show. But that was very interesting. They said they entered into an agreement with the ICC that was fraudulent because the ICC did not uphold its end of the bargain. Am I right?
Exactly. So they claimed they were false pretenses. They signed and ratified when what they claim is a fraudulent promise that was made to them that the court, and I mean it's in the statute, I mean they're not making this up, that the court would respect what's known as the principle of complementarity. So complementarity simply means that the ICC functions as a complement to domestic states and not in lieu of. In other words, the ICC should exercise jurisdiction only when a state is unwilling or unable to do so.
Mm-hmm. But when was that ever tested at all? And they just overrode that, right?
Well, they absolutely overrode it. I don't have a sense that that Prosecutor Bensouda consulted with the Philippine authorities, asking them, have you determined that crimes of the jurisdiction of the ICC have in fact been committed in Philippines? And if so, have you investigated them? Do you plan on investigating them? Do you plan on carrying out prosecutions? I know of no evidence that would establish that. And so therefore, they absolutely jumped the gun. And that's really opened up, I think, a valid argument on behalf of the Filipino authorities to say, actually, we were misled.
Mm-hmm.
At the signature of this document, because we thought the ICC would respect the principles and indeed the legal provisions enshrined in the Rome Statute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's mm-hmm. a very strong argument on their part in terms of this withdrawal.
Yeah, we're speaking to Tiffan Dixon, who is a professor and I guess political science law. I know you're an authority on international law since you practiced it and written about it for many years. This matter of they also say that Bensouda, the prosecutor, doesn't go by her own criteria. They said like there is the matter of is the state unwilling or unable, which that has not been tested at all, and is it in the interest of justice? But we're not talking about a war crime. We're not talking about genocide. This is an internal matter to the Philippines. It has to do with the criminal introduction of drugs at such a rate and type that the Philippine youth are dying, and the police have been given the authority to try to do something about it. And for crying out loud, how does that become the basis of somebody at The Hague prosecuting the president, the elected president of a country that has a Congress and has an attorney general, right?
Yeah, that's when we really get into the the dirty politics of international criminal law that we've seen in any event since the 90s. So if I may offer an opinion, but this seems, and back to our conversation, the beginning of the conversation, this seems like a cynical bid to show the world that Fatou Bensouda is not only prosecuting Africans, she's also prosecuting a Pacific leader who's happens to be very unpopular in the West. So that would be consistent to see investigating and prosecuting people who are unpopular has always been a leitmotif of international criminal law. But in this case, it seems like a very politically easy gambit for Bensouda right now.
Yes.
Because, though there's a preliminary investigation into crimes committed in Afghanistan, those are going to be war crimes or crimes against humanity, though allegedly there's an investigation into American armed forces and CIA crimes in Afghanistan, I understand that already the United States has claimed complementarity in the sense that we've committed no crimes, but if we have, we've investigated and prosecuted them. And so given the fact that outlook doesn't look very positive for the ICC in terms of widening the ambit of its investigations, Philippines looks like that weak state that they'll be able to go after for what I think are kind of base political reasons in terms of the ICC's internal functioning and indeed its funding. Now, you raise the question of what offense is this anyway in terms of international law? So, as you point out, it's not genocide. Genocide is a number of different actions with the intent to destroy in whole or in part ethnic, national, religious group as such. That's not happening. As far as I know, drug dealers don't enjoy the protection of international law.
Yeah, it's not a religion. It's a business.
Yeah, it's a business. And it's not a war crime. There's no armed conflict, as they point out in their 15-page document. So what would it be? A crime against humanity. Crime against humanity, again, there's a number of enumerated acts that are covered under that offense. So killing is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be generalized and systematic.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a situation of wanton murders, and they point out. It's a matter of fact, but they point out that any of these killings has been done in self defense of police officers. But whether or not one believes that, this is not a crime against humanity. This is not, widespread, general, and systematic killings. Mm-hmm. That's not what the drafters of that offense were thinking of, because that offense was conceived of in the Nuremberg in the Nuremberg proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about law enforcement. So that's odd, and they point out that this does not doesn't satisfy the ICC's gravity threshold before they can even investigate. And they're not going to look into these really low-level offenses. And as you point out, in a domestic context.
Mm-hmm.
So this clearly is doesn't respect the gravity requirement of the Rome Statute itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're right to point that out, and also, I guess, the argument that they're insisting on, in order to also escape the provision under the Rome Statute, that withdrawal is effective at the very earliest a year after the statement of withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
What they're saying is that according to the Constitution of the Philippines, no law is binding unless it's been published in their official gazette or in a national newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so the claim is that didn't happen. So, in fact, their adhesion to the ICC was never binding from the date of the signature. So they signed, they ratified, but it never appeared published in the official gazette. And they refer to a Supreme Court case that confirms this. And not in the case of the ICC, but in a previous case.
Yeah.
That
by
a law
the way,
is not
that,
binding.
That's a very important tactical moment, isn't it? Because I noticed that the ICC, very much like a political entity, said, oh, well, he's withdrawing, but we would still have him for the year, the time during which they were a signatory. But now it's checkmate on that one, that front, if I know anything about chess. But no, because they didn't, that it was never published. And you can't tell somebody we're enforcing a law that has never been publicly acknowledged to be a law.
Absolutely. And so it's not a matter if they say, well, no, but, you know, domestic law doesn't trump international criminal law. You have to understand that this is connected to a principle in international law as well, which is identical to domestic law, which is ignorance of the law is no defense, right? That's mm-hmm. the corollary of we have to publish laws.
Yes.
And only when a law has been published in accordance to a constitution.
Yeah. Well, Pascal once said, laws are passed to create criminals. And you have to let the world know that you've done that so that you can go and round them up. But I'm very impressed with the arguments that I've seen there. Of course, he invokes something that I know that is be close to your heart and to anybody who cares about international law. We already have powerful states and a person of Bill Clinton and of now George W. Bush, that they said, well, we're not going to sign that because we think it might be politicized. Well,
of course.
If it occurs to Washington, why can't it occur to the Philippines? That, yes, you're right, and we don't intend to have it applied to us either.
Yeah, the politicized prosecutor is actually, this is a hilarious argument that, dates from the Clinton times, where, simultaneously, the U.S. could say, oh, my goodness, this kind of prosecutor, this is not for American citizens who enjoy, you know, the guarantees of due process and a jury trial. So simultaneously complaining of the ICC's deficiency in that respect and supporting the ICTR and ICTY, who similarly have a politicized prosecutor, and, you know, dubious due process guarantees, certainly no jury trial, no subpoena. That kind of thing. So that's been the experience of the United States. No, they also mention out of the five permanent Security Council members, only two are members of the ICC, France and Great Britain. And they could have added that out of those two, France and Great Britain, they've been the ones actively lobbying the assembly of state parties of the ICC create a mechanism in which states that have not ratified the crime of aggression would not be held to aggression. So this is maybe a long kind of technical story, mm-hmm. but back in 2010, the ICC finally defined the crime of aggression. It was there from the inception of the thing, but they couldn't come up with a definition. It was too hard to figure out what is aggression.
Yes.
We have it in the Nuremberg judgment.
Yeah.
You could figure that out in 46, but it was just really, really hard.
And we've declined since then.
Right.
Yeah.
And absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I believe and I've argued that what's been happening since the 90s is the decriminalization of aggression. But in 2010, they finally come up with something and they define the offense. And that's funny because their definition is in fact a cut and paste of the General Assembly resolution on aggression from 1974.
Mm-hmm.
So they have that, and what they decide, because there are a lot of nervous states there, including non-member states who showed up at this meeting in Kampala in 2010, the United States in particular, and they came up with something called an opt-out clause. So there would be a crime of aggression, but states could opt out, mm-hmm. because it's only, according to Nuremberg, the supreme international crime. So you can imagine the supreme domestic crime like murder. You can opt out of that if you don't feel like being held by it. So France and in Great Britain, there was another meeting last December. They were pushing hard because they haven't ratified aggression yet.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, out of NATO members, I believe only Spain has ratified it.
Well, of course, they both practice it and threaten it. And by the way, isn't threatening aggression also part of that?
Yep, it's absolutely in the definition. Yeah, and that's been our understanding in international law since 1974.
Yeah. We're speaking to Tiffany Dixon, expert in international law and one who's practiced law at The Hague and former International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. It strikes me, Duterte, the president, has come in for a lot of grief because people don't like his shirts or the way he talks or whatever it is. But as you point out, he's written this document is very solid, and there's plenty of meat in it for lawyers. If you want to think about the law, this is a good document. And at the same time, we have people talking about him who are from the United Nations, and he names them in his document. Agnes Callamard and Zayed al-Hussein. They are on the level of the most low rank, I would guess, would be the politician, because Zayed al-Hussein actually said publicly that President Duterte of the Philippines ought to get a psychiatric examination. Why isn't he fired immediately for such an asinine thing to say about the elected president representing 100 million people in a strategic part of the world? And a clown like Zayed Hussein can just shoot his mouth off about him? I personally, if I was President Duterte, I'd rip up all those UN documents and ask them to arrest that moron.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's not a big diplomat, is he? And you
know he's a prince, by the way.
He's actually prince. Oh, there you go.
He's a prince in Jordan.
Yes.
He's not allowed to use his title. By the way, that's not an honorific. There's money that goes with that. He is also the first in line to become the president of Iraq, were the monarchy to be restored. He would be the king of Iraq. And this idiot... wants to talk about human rights and international law, and he talks about psychiatric examinations of a democratically elected president. Maybe he does have a little of that monarchist blood in him.
So it would appear. You know, he has been taken to task before by the late Vitaly Churkin of the Russian Federation in the Security Council, asking him to sort of check himself. This is not the language of a diplomat, for heaven's sake. And that statement about the psychiatric examination is even included in the withdrawal. It just shows that this character is costing membership to the ICC. Of course he should be fired.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
he's not up to the task.
And other member states who think they believe in international law, it should be their concern, even if they don't like President Duterte. They should say, we can't have people... If we're going to make this an effective system, you can't have people talking like that. That's not only a presumption of guilt, it's a presumption of madness, which he's alleging, against the head of state. It really is a sorry situation.
it reminds me of a French saying, which is, quand tu veux tuer ton chien, tu dis qu'il a la rage. When you want to kill your dog, you say he has rabies. And this is exactly that. This al-Husseini has basically said that Duterte has psychiatric rabies.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to what? Well, in order to, quote-unquote, kill him.
Mm-hmm.
At least, just metaphorically.
No, I mean, that is President Duterte's point, in sense, is it not? I mean, he's saying, do not kid me. When this prosecutor of yours uses this language, the presumption of guilt is built into it. And I'm being labeled on the world stage, and the next thing I know, someone's going to be bombing me, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are precedents that are not too far in time. If anyone was still sanguine about international criminal law, unless they weren't total cynics, they stopped being so in 2011,
mm-hmm.
with the bombing of Libya. And certainly that was the case for Russia and China. I mean, they voted for this direction of the prosecutor, then Moreno Ocampo, to investigate Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam, and Senussi for crimes against humanity back then, and also the so-called no-fly zone. And as we've seen, those votes don't reoccur. Mm-hmm. Those votes don't reoccur. Not for Syria, not for Burundi, not for anything. There's not going to be a directed investigation into a non-state party. Not for the next couple of decades. I can't see it because that is indeed instrumentalized and weaponized. Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. Mm-hmm. That the bombs come. There's some precedent for that. And President Milosevic of Yugoslavia before him in 99.
Please repeat that about Milosevic case.
Yes, well, President of Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic, was, himself the target of international criminal law, of the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia. Then prosecutor, Canadian Louise Arbour, in the midst of a NATO, an illegal NATO bombing campaign of 78 days and 78 nights, right smack in the middle, she brought an indictment against him and said that he's no longer a suitable guarantor for any peace talks.
My goodness.
So we know the connection between...
All the alarm bells should have rung at that time for anybody who cared about international justice. Lawyers, prosecutors as politicians is a horrible sight. Again, well, I want to say we've been speaking to Tiffin Dixon. I want to introduce a point here. Tiffin, your father, Robert Dixon, was a distinguished Ontario-based poet known throughout the world, but and winner of prizes for literature. We interviewed him on this show, and we're sad to say this is the anniversary of his passing. How many years has it been now?
11
years. Could you tell us briefly about your father? And he was a leading Franco-Ontarian advocate, right?
Yes. My father was, first of all, a professor of French-Canadian literature at Laurentian University in Sudbury, but he was also and mostly and most passionately an advocate and participant in Franco-Ontarian culture, be it music. He wrote lyrics for the group Canot. Theater, translation, film, a great translator of plays, and of course a poet in his own right, winner of the Governor General's Award for poetry, what feels like just a few years ago, but I guess it's a bit longer than that. And my father, this was one of the worst, this date, this March 19th was one of the days that he was the most angry about, because it was the beginning of the aggression against Iraq. He was also a devoted union member and anti-imperialist and signatory of petitions in favor of Milosevic, and a great supporter of my work and of the prisoners of the ICTR. And yeah,
well, I've
missed much more than, I mean, it's not only missed in terms of culture, but very much in terms of his political contributions as well.
So, you see, we know the father, and we understand the daughter, Tiffin Dixon. Thank you very, very much for talking to us. We do remember him well, and your work has been outstanding, and this is a very important contribution. We want our listeners to be talking about the failure of the International Criminal Court to live up to its advertisement. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Phil.
Okay, dog. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Taylor Report, CIT 9.5. We're going to hear a little bit of Green Onions, I think, and then we will come back and talk to Steve Gowans.